We are talking once again with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
And starting out with, you know, I'm starting to think that maybe we need to get Mayor Durkan a new pen because she doesn't seem to be signing anything lately.
No, you know, about a month ago, the city council passed their revised bill.
Hard to sign things from Hawaii or wherever it is she's been having a vacation for the last year.
Right. Yeah, wherever it is she's been stashed. About a month ago, the city council passed their revised bill to restrict the Seattle Police Department's use of less lethal weapons against crowds of demonstrators. Over the course of a year, the council had worked to put together a revised ban that they thought would pass muster with Judge James Robart, the court-appointed monitor, and Antonio Aftili, and the Department of Justice. So they spent months and months working on that bill. Council member Lisa Herbold held public hearings on the bill. She took feedback from the three oversight bodies whose work formed the basis of the new bill, and she even sought feedback from the Seattle Police Department. She met privately with the court monitor and a representative from the Department of Justice to get their insight onto the bill. And even the Seattle City Attorney's Office did a full review of the bill to make sure it passed legal muster and was in compliance with the new state laws passed by the legislature earlier this year. But Mayor Durkan ignored all of that. And in a letter she wrote to the council this week, asserted that the bill would not pass legal muster, was in direct conflict with those new laws passed by the state legislature, and that it, quote, places SPD in the unfair and untenable position of proposing and defending to the DOJ and the court law that it cannot support as best practice, end quote. So she refused. She returned the bill to the city council and refused to sign it. She appears to be agreeing with the Seattle Police Department that police riots, tear gassing a peaceful crowd just to make it move, and denying people their right to free speech under the U.S. Constitution is a quote-unquote best practice. Okay? She wants the police department to be, and this is, these are words taken directly out of her letter, agile. And able to, quote, to make, quote, reflective policy changes on an ongoing basis, end quote. And so in her mind, no tactics should be off limits. None whatsoever. And she touts the recent minimal changes that the Seattle Police Department made to its crowd control policies, saying that they consulted with the three oversight bodies, the Office of Police Accountability, the Office of the Inspector General, the Seattle Police Department, and the Community Police Commission. And that is true. They did talk to those three bodies, but then the Seattle Police Department didn't actually follow most of their recommendations. Whereas Councilmember Herbold based the new bill on the recommended changes that all three bodies could agree on. So that was the starting point for the bill. Durkan then slams the council for not waiting until the Office of Inspector General and the OPA finish hearing all the complaints from last year's protests and issuing formal reports on what went wrong and what needs to change. Now, keep in mind that both of those bodies release recommendations regularly as each batch of complaints is investigated and recommendations are made on potential discipline and changes at the SPD. So it's not a secret, right, how they feel about SPD's crowd control policies.
Not like the mayor's texts.
I know. Durkan, however, doesn't hold the Seattle Police Department to that same standard. She doesn't criticize them for making quick, minor changes to their crowd control policy before the OIG and the OPA are done with their review of all of the incidents last year. Because, of course, we know what their criticisms are. They're not a secret, right? That's partly why the state legislature tackled this issue earlier this year, is because of what happened in 2020. So you know, the fact that she could write this self-serving pro-SPD screed and return the bill without signing it is just difficult to stomach, I have to say. And she's showing again that she's a conservative law and order Republican who reflexively defends the police even when they've committed serious constitutional violations.
I looked at that letter and I wondered if Mike Solon just wrote it and gave it to her.
I know. I just looked at it and it's like somebody at SPD wrote a draft and she put her name on it, essentially. Right. In fact, Durkin says in that letter that the bill to restrict less lethal weapons was a knee-jerk reaction. And I have to say, no, it was not a knee-jerk reaction. In fact, Durkin's refusal to sign it is a knee-jerk reaction. And her letter contains so many untruths and inconsistencies that it's really difficult to take it seriously. And I should note that the bill passed the city council unanimously. No, not a single one of the council members voted against it. Not Deborah Juarez, not Alex Peterson, the people you would expect to. So Durkin could have vetoed it, but of course she knew that the city council would overwhelmingly override her veto. Instead, the bill will become law without her signature. The Seattle Police Department will be required to draft new crowd control policy provisions to match the terms of the bill within 60 days. Then the Department of Justice and the court monitor will review those new SPD crowd control policies and make recommendations to Judge Robart. Robart will then review the new crowd control policy, and if he approves of the changes, then the bill becomes law and the new crowd control policy goes into effect at the Seattle Police Department. Then the SPD will have 30 days to train all of their officers on the new policy. So that's the course of the bill at this point. The fact that Durkin didn't sign it isn't going to stop it from going into law, but it really does show you where she's coming from.
It also won't stop her from claiming credit for the new crowd control policies once the SPD adopts them.
Right, or saying, hey, I'm the one who is overseeing reform at the Seattle Police Department. The city council isn't involved at all, right?
You know, I was reminded this week via the Facebook app for, you know, bringing back memories, specific memories that happened like a year ago or years ago, that KOW and others had carried news of people who had been impacted by the use of tear gas and other gases. People who were both in the crowds, but people who are also up on Capitol Hill within their homes.
Exactly.
And it had some people who had suffered three periods within a month from extreme exposure to these gases,
which puts you at serious risk of anemia. And anemia is not something to take lightly. It can have wider effects in the body, particularly on your heart. So that is pretty serious. And, you know, clearly something's going wrong with your hormones there when you're being exposed to a gas that does something like that. And hormones have a wider effect in the body, not just on your reproductive system. They have effects in the brain, on the nervous system, on your digestive tract, you name it.
So these are just some of the impacts of these weapons that they're using.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently Mayor Durkin is fine with that.
Yeah, she's fine with that. That those are tactics that should be in the SPD's arsenal, according to her.
Yeah, because peaceful demonstrators have to be moved.
Yeah, and I couldn't disagree more. I mean, there are some tactics that have to be off limits. And these untargeted, broad spectrum gassing whole groups of people, particularly when they're peaceful, and gassing whole neighborhoods, that's got to be off the table.
Yeah. Collective punishment is one concept that they seem to employ. All right. Moving on to this week's election news.
Yeah, talking a little bit about the Recall Sawant campaign. They submitted their signatures this week, so just a few days after the cutoff to submit signatures for initiatives to get on the ballot for November. The Recall Sawant campaign finally submitted about 16,000 signatures to King County Elections. Now, if 10,687 of those signatures are validated in the next 2 to 4 weeks, then the recall will likely appear on a ballot in February. A February special election would be my guess of when it would appear. So it does appear that, the Recall Sawant campaign intentionally delayed submitting the signatures in order to prevent a large turnout in November from rejecting their recall. But the Shama Solidarity campaign has a lot of support in District 3. And of course, only District 3 voters will be able to vote on the recall. Now, the Shama Solidarity campaign has raised about $687,555 and has spent 86% of that on a number of things like salaries, phone banking, canvassing, mailers, postage, office supplies, rent, email lists, etc., all the usual campaign expenses. On the other hand, the Recall Sawant campaign has raised $625,899 and spent a little over 70% of that, much of it on paid signature gatherers, consulting fees, signage, and paid travel expenses for their campaign manager, Henry John Bridger II, who has previously worked in sales and marketing in the cruise industry.
So we can credit Shama Sawant with you know, contributing to the Seattle economy.
Yeah. In July, the Recall Sawant campaign spent about $12,500, just looking at their campaign expenditure reports, they spent $12,500 as partial payment for a poll conducted by Strategies 360, but they haven't publicly released the results of the poll, so I'm guessing it probably wasn't favorable to them. And I'm guessing it informed their decision to not get the recall on the November ballot. That's what I'm guessing that poll was for.
Wow.
Strategies
360, I just want to include the note, is a crisis management organization. To give you an idea of what they're reaching out for in the toolbox.
Yeah, what they're paying them for. Now, yeah. Also in June and July, the Recall Sawant campaign placed orders for $58,000 in legal consulting, $19,000 on fundraising and compliance consulting, over $9,000 in general strategy consulting, and $4,800 in field consulting. Okay, so that shows you that somebody is making big bucks off of this campaign, right? So it raises the question of who are these folks? Now, aside from the two firms that work for a lot of professional political campaigns, like the law firm Davis Wright Tremaine and Blue Wave Political Partners, there are three individuals listed as quote-unquote consultants on the campaign. One is Dean Ordello. He was a self-employed massage therapist whose business is named Recharge Reflexology. The second one is Quentin Burkumpas, who graduated from WSU in the spring of 2020 and worked as a, quote, regional mobilization manager for John Ossoff's U.S. Senate campaign in Georgia in 2020. So he's young and probably the gopher guy here. And the third one is Jake Cox, a customer experience lead at Safara, which appears to be a travel website. His resume looks like he's never spent more than a year or two, and sometimes only a few months, at any one of the many, many jobs he's got listed on his LinkedIn page. So there you have it. Three young white guys who hate Shama, essentially. Also,
or being paid to hate Shama.
Yeah. Also, let's not forget Ernie Liu, who filed the recall initiative in the first place. Liu is a self-employed corporate business consultant. He's pro-LGBTQ, but is an ardent capitalist who hates Shama's pro-worker policies. Among the biggest donors to the Recall Sawant campaign, so the people who are funding all this, are many, many real estate developers and managers from companies like Rainier Pacific Company, O'Keefe Development, Washington Real Estate Acquisitions, Remax Northwest, Gallagher Properties, Metropolitan Homes Corp, Build Sound LLC, Bloom Company Real Estate, Wright Runstad & Company, Plus One Construction LLC, Paragon Real Estate, Windermere, Icon Real Estate Services, Goodman Real Estate, Turning Point Realty Advisors, Steel Homes, when am I going to stop, right? Delta Tech Construction, Dunlop.
I'm sensing a theme here.
Yes, and it just goes on and on and on. And those are just a few of the folks off the top of the list. You know, so when Shama's supporters say it's these real estate folks who are going after her, and the Recall Sawant campaign says, oh, no, no, we're a diverse group of individuals. That's not true. That's absolutely not true. It's primarily folks who are in the real estate industry who are going after Shama Sawant. And I'd say there's probably a lot of crossover between the folks who support Bruce Harrell and are contributing to the political action committee that is supporting Bruce Harrell's candidacy and the folks who are supporting the Recall Sawant campaign.
Yeah, and they'll be firing up the Recall All Over campaign soon enough.
Yeah. Once Nikita Oliver is elected to the city council.
Yeah, I think she's going to be a bigger problem for a lot of people than Sawant, honestly.
Yeah, and you know, there was an interesting piece in Publicola, on the Publicola blog this week, and it's probably still the lead piece up there right now, that has photos of Sarah Nelson's business, Fremont Brewing Company, with these huge blocks blocking the parking outside of the business in order to keep homeless people in SUVs from parking next to the Fremont Brewing plant.
Yeah, they call them eco blocks.
Eco blocks, yeah.
No, I don't know who came up with that name.
Yeah, I don't know. Probably to make them seem less like building blocks for a bunker, like a military style bunker, which is really what they are.
Exactly. They're the type of thing that they put in front of the White House to keep vehicles from driving through, you know.
Yeah, or the things that they used in Iraq to block
yes.
traffic into the green zone. Essentially, they're yet another piece of technology that was pioneered by the military and has now found uses in the civilian sector. And in this case, Sarah Nelson and her company decided to put them around the Fremont Brewing plant in order to keep homeless people from parking next to their company.
I guess put them around their campaign headquarters there.
Yeah, and you know, Erica Barnett points out on in her article on the Publicola blog that industrial areas in the city of Seattle are really the only places where people who are living out of their cars or their RVs can actually park, since they've been harassed and driven out of so many other areas of the city. And there are no parking lots or parking spaces that are set aside for homeless people living in their vehicles. And so they've been kind of clustering in commercial areas and industrial areas. And that now it appears that it's become a thing for certain right-wing industrial business owners to put out these eco blocks.
But she also points out that they're
illegal.
Illegal. Well, illegal on public space.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're private property, you can do what you
want. Yeah, but it's not their private property. It's parking spaces on the street. So it's right. absolutely illegal that they're doing it. And she's running for city. And Sarah Nelson's running for city council. The city, however, is not going to spend the money to send out a forklift and a flatbed trailer and truck to haul those blocks away. So they stay there. And that should be a political issue that Sarah Nelson should answer to.
Well, especially if she's on the law and order ticket.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, how can you be on the law and order ticket running for the city council when you're breaking the law right now?
Well, because she makes sure that SPD won't enforce it because they like her.
Well, and she knows the city won't enforce it because the city's not going to pay the money to do it.
Right.
Although I have to tell you, if I was in SDOT, I would remove the blocks and send her the bill.
It sounds like a
plan. And if she and her husband don't pay it, then I'd send the police.
Yeah, or take her to court.
Yeah, take her to court.
So we like to cover polls when they happen. At least on occasion, especially
election. Yes, Mike, and I understand that you took a couple of polls this week.
I did, and I was really surprised because normally I get a call on the phone, you know, maybe two to three times a year, you know, for taking polls, surveys, and in one night, 20 minutes apart, I had two.
Wow.
So
tell us about it.
The first one was a cross-cut Elway poll that was, you know, way more nuanced than the one that came after it. Pretty straightforward questions. It was actually fun to take. Like I say, 20 minutes later, I get a call from a second poll.
Before you move to the second poll, was the cross-cut Elway poll about just kind of general concerns of voters?
It was almost the exact same poll that they'd done previously. In fact, it even had a question in there regarding CA 29, the
Charter Amendment 29.
Charter Amendment 29.
So trying to kind of gauge what the general voters care about in this election.
Yeah. So it was pretty reasonable. And then I got a second call from what clearly became evident was from the Bruce Harrell, Tim Burgess Chamber of Commerce Coalition. And they were, I'm going to include some of the actual questions here. So first comparison was you have to choose between the two. A, Seattle needs a mayor who stands by their progressive values and drives major systemic change. Or would you prefer Seattle needs a mayor who builds consensus and implements thoughtful policies that achieve lasting solutions?
I don't want lasting solutions or thoughtful policies.
All right. The next question was, Seattle is facing a housing crisis. We need to remove single family zoning laws to increase our housing supply.
Yes.
Or B, we need to protect the character and integrity of existing neighborhoods by maintaining existing zoning laws. So you can see that's
change. Yeah, that's, right.
I don't like the character of my neighborhood.
I don't like the either-or nature of these questions.
I know. It's just – it's real.
There's no middle ground or nuance here.
No,
well, this is what's called a push-pull.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah. And
priming voters to react to and understand appropriately to Bruce Harrell's messaging and then vote for him in November is how push-pulls are designed.
Yeah, and to frame issues in a way that is most favorable to them.
And to narrow the discussion of potential solutions on issues, too. Push polls are particularly insidious for that reason.
And used a lot more and more. Yeah. And finally, city leaders should make sure that local companies pay their fair share in taxes so that we have the resources we need to address Seattle's challenges.
Yes.
Or... city leaders should partner with our local business community to encourage new businesses, keep taxes under control, and to create more jobs with livable wages.
Oh, barf.
Huh.
Oh,
Mike, and Mike, this is what you get for being one of the six people left in the city with a landline.
I know. And what it all ended up leading us into was – them letting us know that they're looking at the creation of a new camp. These are my words, a new campaign to lead the charge, and asks you to rate the names they are giving these new campaign, which we can tell is going to be the Chamber of Commerce campaign. The first one they ask you, and they ask all three of these to rate it on a scale of 1 to 100.
Okay. This is going to be good.
The first one is Recover Seattle. How do you feel about that? Recover Seattle. Okay. And then they ask you.
It's like, did we lose it? Where'd it go? I look out my window and I see desert.
Wait a minute. If Seattle is dying, then Recover Seattle implies bringing it back from the dead. That's kind of creepy.
It's just like grabbing a piece of, restoring your hard drive. It's as simple as that. So then you move on to how do you feel about Restore Seattle? Okay. And then finally.
I restore things from backup. As an IT manager, I restore things from backup all the time. I can't say it's terribly exciting.
Yes. And finally.
I think they just want to bring more retail into downtown. That's what that campaign
will
be about. Yeah,
just say Retail Seattle.
Actually, that was a question in both polls, was whether downtown should be receiving the focus that it does with everybody's efforts. Okay, and then finally, the final choice was take back Seattle.
Who has it? Who there do they think go. Has it now?
That's the take back Seattle really goes to the heart of what they're thinking. Because they're thinking, oh, we're losing the city to the wrong people, right? The workers are taking over, so we got to take it back.
I mean, we ran Seattle for generations, and
we're
rejecting all of our candidates. We don't understand.
We don't understand. We need to take it back.
Yeah. When we all know the only group that could legitimately use Take Back Seattle would be the Duwamish people.
Yeah. I think the appropriate answer to those questions is you guys need somebody else running your campaign for you, because all of these suck.
Are you looking for a consultant? Because I'm available.
No, I'm willing to take thousands of dollars in order to give you better messaging.
Yeah, I could do better than that. I mean, you know. Of course, you know, my 6-year-old nephew could do better than that, but, you know, details.
So, something to keep in mind when people quote polls, you know, that they're heavily biased, depending
on. It's important to look at the way the questions are framed, because the potential answers and the way people answer are kind of narrowly framed within whatever message is being pushed through the way the questions are framed and the way the poll is conducted. So that's
and also what is not asked. I mean, mm-hmm. Were there any questions about homelessness, for example, or is just that's just not a concern now because they've given up on Charter Amendment 29?
Mm-hmm.
There was, I believe, in both surveys, questions that touched on homelessness. And there was also opportunity, well, at least in the Elway poll, there was an opportunity where you just basically got to say, you know, what you think the city should be doing without mm-hmm. constraints. So that they were taking it verbatim.
Well, the Elway poll, yeah, but not in the push poll.
Yeah, because Elway's a legitimate poll.
Exactly. All right. So. Enough of my babbling. Let's...
Thank you for that, Mike.
Sure. Let's touch on this week's COVID-related news.
Oh, boy. Well, we had a near record for the statewide of well over 4,000 on Friday. And same for King County, which is well over 800. The numbers are still a little skewed by the long Liberty weekend, and we'll see what they look like next week. But they do seem to be, after having plateaued for the last several weeks, it looks like they're inching back up again, which is not a good sign. We had a couple of demonstrations that went sideways last weekend. One was in Olympia, where Proud Boys were demonstrating against masks. I don't know why they like uniforms so much. They should be fine with having masks as part of their uniform. But
and they haven't figured out yet what anarchists have and other sort of left of center demonstrators have figured out is that when you wear a mask, it's harder for the police to identify you.
Later. Yeah, well, they're not worried about that.
They're not worried about that because
they're on first name basis with the first name basis with all the cops anyway. One of the Proud Boy demonstrations in Olympia escalated after they were confronted by what the city called anti-fascists. Of course, that's kind of a catch-all for anybody who's against the Proud Boys because they're by definition anti-fascist. They escalated into argument and then a fight, and then one of the Proud Boys pulled out a gun and fired. And apparently one of the counter demonstrators was hit in the ankle. So this was an incident. The city did their best to blame both sides. But once again, the Proud Boys are a fascist organization. That's what they exist for, is to provoke these kind of confrontations. Speaking of which, the other one that's gotten a lot of media attention this week happened down in Clark County in southwest Washington across the river from Portland, where a 14-year-old girl who is a student at one of the high schools there has been trying to lead a campaign against the mask requirements in the schools. And she claims that she is disabled and therefore her disability should exempt her from wearing a mask. It's not clear what she thinks her disability is. And of course, you know, you want to be careful on that because people do have legitimate reasons. For instance, if somebody's severely asthmatic or something, or claustrophobic or whatever it might be. But, she has also called for, voting out all the liberals on the school board, which, kind of tells you where she's coming from. And a lot of the right-wing demonstrators in Vancouver, Patriot Prayer and the Proud Boys and whatnot, have rallied to her cause. And so there have been a couple of demonstrations outside the high school, and there's also a middle school and an elementary school in the same complex. And one of those, a week ago Friday, some Proud Boys basically came on the school property. And, you know, there have been enough incidents around the country where teachers and administrators have been threatened by anti-mask or anti-vaccine demonstrators that the schools automatically locked down, all three of them. And a Clark County district judge ruled this week that he granted an injunction filed by the school district which prohibits any demonstrations within a mile of a Vancouver school district school, which seems kind of excessive. But you have to remember also, when you've got Proud Boys coming on your property, they're most likely armed. And that can go sideways in any number of ways on school property. We don't need any lessons in that anymore. So the anti-mask demonstrators promptly held another rally yesterday in defiance of the injunction. Of course, the police did not intervene. And it's a kind of tense situation down there right now. So we'll see where that goes. But in the meantime, schools in Washington State do have mask requirements at this point. And that's a good thing.
Even though we're not seeing demonstrations and protests here in Seattle or in King County, it doesn't mean that they're not going on in rural areas or areas of the state that are more conservative than here in the Puget Sound.
Well, it's also important to remember that Portland is right across the river from Vancouver, and mm-hmm. there's just been heavy Proud Boy
presence in Portland.
Happened there and had just happened a week prior.
Yeah, and a lot of those groups are based in Sandy, which is an eastern suburb that's right across the river from the 405 bridge into Vancouver. So it's a straight shot. And some of those groups are based in Vancouver also, which has basically become a bedroom community to Portland. Mm-hmm. It's a tense situation down there. And hopefully cooler heads will prevail, but I wouldn't count on it.
Hopefully there won't be any more shootings or gun mishaps like there was this past weekend.
Yeah. And we should also mention that the pandemic has particularly become severe in eastern Washington, in the Spokane area, and across the border in northern Idaho, where the hospitals in Coeur d'Alene and areas in the northern Idaho panhandle have become so overwhelmed that the state yesterday granted permission for hospitals in that district to start rationing care. That is to say, start denying care to people that they don't think they can be saved so they can free up the bed space for people that can be treated.
And that's an issue that's not discussed a whole lot, particularly in the media, is what happens if you, say, have a heart attack or stroke or something that is life-threatening that's not COVID-related. You go to the hospital and there are no beds available because they're taken up by people with COVID-19.
Unvaccinated people.
Mostly unvaccinated people.
And Idaho has now implemented Sarah Palin's death panels. It took about a decade to come true, but it did. And it wasn't the left wing that was implementing them as in her nightmare scenario. It was Republican governments that had refused to take the pandemic seriously or refused to intervene in it. Don't go to Spokane these days because it's pretty hot right now in terms of being a hot spot for COVID-19. And we had the implementation just in time of the state of a statewide ban on gatherings of more than 500 people without mask requirements. So now any group of 500 or more, and this is something King County implemented a few weeks ago, but the state just implemented this past week that, any crowds at, for instance, sporting events or, large churches even, you have to be wearing a mask. And, certainly all of Seattle's professional and college teams have announced that they will require both masks and vaccinations at their games going forward. That includes the Seahawks, the Sounders, UW football, and most importantly, I think, the new hockey team, the Kraken, because that will be an indoor venue when their season starts next month. So be interesting to see if despite those requirements, because, those teams will all draw crowds from, not just from King County, but from all over the Northwest, including areas with relatively low vaccination rates, whether in fact, you start getting, clusters of cases associated with one or another event. Yeah, we've certainly seen that so far with some of the fairs, because it's also fair season, with concerts out at the Gorge and other outdoor venues. And so,
Last weekend there was some kind of large gathering at the Seattle Center where many of the people were unmasked. And I was looking at that going, hey, this is crazy. A certain number of these people are going to be taking COVID-19 home with them.
Yeah, and the night before, I think this was last Monday, but the night before the ban on, having events without masking, took place, there was an enormous Green Day concert at T-Mobile Park. So, which we could hear from here because, our place overlooks the stadiums. Mm-hmm. So,
And King County.
So they were singing all night, which is like nightmare scenario, right?
Yeah. When you're in an audience, everybody in the audience is singing along. So that's
what I meant. The crowd was singing.
That's maximum COVID spread event right there. Yes. Now, King County has said that if you are unvaccinated, according to their King County Department of Health statistics, you are 50 times more likely to be hospitalized if you catch COVID-19 in King County. You are 30 times more likely to die and 7 times more likely to actually catch the virus. So your risk is not doubled or tripled or quadrupled. It's septupled, okay, to actually catch the virus. And then once you have it, you are 50 times more likely to be hospitalized and 30 times more likely to die. Okay. Now the age range that is most at risk right now in King County is the 18 to 29 year old range. They're at higher risk than kids under the age of 12 who are going to school and who can't get vaccinated yet. The 18 to 29 year old range, they take bigger risks. And I should point out, they're paying for it by getting sicker more than any other age group, and they're the least likely to be able to afford the cost of healthcare if they have to go to the hospital. So if you know somebody in that age range who's not vaccinated, just take them inside and say, look, you are just starting your adult life. Why would you cripple yourself with that kind of debt? Go get the free vaccine.
Okay? Or additional debt if they tried to go to college.
Yeah. It's hard enough to get out from under college debt. Why would you double or triple or quadruple that? Okay. So let's talk a little bit about the national COVID-19 news that the CDC said nationally unvaccinated people are 11 times nationwide are 11 times more likely to die of COVID-19. I think they're probably underestimating that because of reporting issues. President Biden this week ordered a vaccine mandate for private companies that employ more than 100 people. Either their employees must get vaccinated or they have to be tested every week. At the same time, he strengthened his mandate for federal employees to get vaccinated or get fired with no testing alternative for federal employees. That was challenged by some of the unions representing federal employees, saying that he should have bargained the terms with the unions before announcing the mandate.
This is what an emergency is called.
Yeah, especially federal law enforcement, the Federal Law Enforcement Officers Association, which called vaccination a, quote, individual medical decision. And they called the decision to not get vaccinated a, quote, unquote, reasonable medical choice, end quote. And I have to say no, no, and no. All right. In a public health emergency, there is no bargaining. That's kind of like a child wanting to bargain with their parents when and if they can run out into traffic. And that's just stupid. Okay. Also, the Federal Law Enforcement Officers Association is completely wrong. Vaccinations are not just an individual medical decision. And choosing to not get vaccinated is not a reasonable medical choice. It is not reasonable. All right.
Yeah, it is. You know, it's not individual when you're dealing with an extremely contagious communicable disease.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And likewise, I should point out too, there should not be a religious exemption. Okay. I know some people are going to be offended when I say that, but there should not be a religious exemption when it comes to a public health emergency. Multiple court cases in the United States have shown that you can't use religious beliefs as the basis to endanger someone's health, and people who refuse the vaccine are endangering other people's health.
Yep. Yeah. And, you know, if your imaginary sky friend is not going to protect you, it's certainly not going to protect me.
No. And so, yeah, it is time to get tough about vaccination, but I think it's also time for employers to make it easier for their workers to get the shot. Biden has ordered private employers to provide time off for their employees to get vaccinated. I would go a step further and require employers to schedule vaccine days when their employees can get the shot while they're at work, and then allow them to take a paid sick day the next day if they need it to recover from the side effects.
Yeah, so let me talk a little bit about some of the aspects of Biden's plan. This was all announced on Thursday. The Labor Department is supposedly going to develop an emergency rule requiring all private sector businesses with more than 100 employees to require that their workforces be fully vaccinated or test negative at least once a week. That rule alone is going to affect an estimated 80 million workers. And, I wish there were not an opt-out test requirement or a test protocol there, but as Maria mentioned, our employers will also be required to give paid time off for employees to get vaccinated. So that's a big deal. Biden signed an executive order requiring all executive branch employees and federal contractors to be vaccinated, and that's not something that's being widely reported, the contractors, because there's a huge number of contractors to the federal government, and they are covered under that executive order as well.
Yeah, and I should point out in contrast to the Federal Law Enforcement Officers Association, the union that represents contractors to the federal government is 100% behind the vaccine mandate. They think they say that their union members fully support it and would feel much safer if they knew that other federal employees were also vaccinated.
Yeah, I wish all of organized labor were that sensible.
Were that sensible, yeah.
Nearly 300,000 educators who work in federally run school programs would be required to be vaccinated. That's another aspect of it. And the Education Department is moving to take legal action against Republican efforts to bar school districts from having mask mandates. That's going to be a big deal. There have been a lot of headlines from Florida, of course, as the DeSantis school mask ban works its way up through the appeals courts in Florida. And it's gotten high enough in the process now that DeSantis has stacked the appeals courts and the Florida Supreme Court with his own appointees, and so they're starting to rule in favor of him. The only recourse at that point, once it goes to the Florida Supreme Court, where it'll almost certainly be upheld, will be to take it to the federal Supreme Court, and God knows how they'll rule. So in any event, Biden has said he will also the feds will pay the salaries of any school district administrators who defy the ban. And districts representing over half of Florida students are now defying DeSantis' ban and ordering masks in their schools because they don't want their kids to die, and they don't want their educators to die. There was a cluster of about 13 educators in South Florida who died this past week from the coronavirus. And that is a sign, unfortunately, of things to come, I think, in states that have these bans. Florida is the most high profile of them, but it's by far not the only one.
I think also another great step that the federal government could do is to set up a database for people to register when they've been vaccinated, so it's really easy and seamless for folks to keep track of vaccination status. So there's none of this, I lost my vaccination card, or I don't have my vaccination card with me, or
I paid somebody to forge a vaccination card.
Yeah, idiots selling fake vaccine cards. That's a system that's just not workable in the long term, keeping a piece of paper in your wallet to carry around with you. I think it would also help people to remember when they need to get a recommended booster, if it was an electronic record rather than a piece of paper in their wallet. And it would help them remember when they've been vaccinated against which variants, as new variants arise and boosters are created to treat variants that are not adequately that for which you don't have antibodies yet from the original vaccine.
I mean, you've got more.
And we know that those inevitably will come.
You've got more sophisticated programs than that on your smartphone.
Yes.
It's not hard.
Yeah. So that would be another step for the federal government to take that they've just not done yet, and that public health officials and public health groups have recommended that the Biden administration do, but that they've resisted so far.
Yeah, and of course, a number of Republican governors have promised to file suit to prevent the feds from, you know, saving lives. They're particularly objecting to the private employer vaccination mandate, which this is an emergency. I mean, nearly 700,000 people have died in the United States in the last 18 months. And, you know, honestly, an awful lot of it is the direct result of the politicization of this pandemic. And, you know, I blame Trump. I really do. He set the stupid in motion. It was certainly there already, but he set it in motion and has legitimized it as a culture war thing. And you're seeing now Republicans all over the country parodying this and basically being, you know, pro-death. In the state of Texas, the only thing that has reproductive rights any longer is the coronavirus. That has reproductive rights.
I hadn't thought of it that way. But speaking of Texas, we could talk a little bit about how the Justice Department is suing to block the Texas abortion ban.
Yeah, let's get to that, because we only have about, 10 minutes left, Mike?
Yeah, just under.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah, this week, U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland announced that the Department of Justice filed a lawsuit this week in federal court in Austin, Texas, to ask a federal judge to block the enforcement of Texas's new abortion ban, clearly unconstitutional under the Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade decision. The Department of Justice is taking this step, according to Garland, to, quote, ensure that no state can deprive individuals of their constitutional rights, end quote. Which kind of leads me to wonder if the U.S. Department of Justice cares about voting rights, but that's another issue. Now, the lawsuit argues that the Texas ban violates the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, imposes an undue burden on women, and interferes with the federal government's constitutional obligation to provide access to abortion services, including in the cases of rape and incest, and to women who are in custody in federal prisons. Okay. About a dozen other states have passed similar bans on abortion after 6 weeks of pregnancy when many women don't even know they're pregnant yet.
Which is the point.
Yeah, right. Those laws have all been blocked by federal judges because they violate Roe v. Wade. So there's a strong precedent for getting the Texas law blocked too. Now, the lawsuit also seeks to prevent private individuals from taking advantage of the vigilante provisions in the Texas law that would allow them to sue anyone who helps a woman obtain an abortion. That can be anything from helping a woman schedule an appointment to driving a woman to a clinic to counseling her on her reproductive options, even helping a woman cross state lines to get an abortion in another state.
And you know who is particularly alarmed by that provision is Uber and Lyft, because their drivers are also legally liable.
Yeah. So there are pretty good precedents for blocking that part of the law too, because some local women's groups in the state of Texas have obtained restraining orders against anti-abortion groups that have tried to take advantage of the new law already to sue them. So some pro-choice women's groups have already confronted this issue with anti-abortion groups and have blocked their lawsuits in court. So there's good precedent for that as well. So the Department of Justice is no longer sitting on the sidelines in the Texas abortion ban case. They're actually moving forward with trying to get it blocked while it makes its way through the courts.
Yeah, and I'm still most concerned with that law with the vigilante provision, because that can be used for virtually anything to evade any kind of legal accountability.
Yeah, you now could, women's groups may have more resources than, say, individual women would have. So it's, I think, the real challenge is going to be when those anti-abortion groups start picking individual women to sue and take to court, or their spouses, say, if a husband drives his wife out of state to get an abortion.
Yeah.
That's going to be one of the things that arises from this fight. And we'll see how this all develops in the coming months.
Yeah. So for instance, since the Supreme Court has set the precedent of not ruling on a law because they don't have standing, because it's not the state that's enforcing it. So what if the state wants to set up private enforcement to prevent, say, black people from voting? That's a constitutional right as well. And, the precedent there is really terrifying, and it's, I'm sure it's not going to take the right wing long to figure that out.
Yeah, and I think, progressive lawyers who have been watching this say that that part of the lawsuit to prevent individuals in the state of Texas from suing people who assist women in getting an abortion really hinges on whether the individuals pursuing those lawsuits, the anti-abortion groups, can be seen as agents of the state because they're doing the enforcement of the law instead of the state doing the enforcement of the law. And that's going to be what's at the root of whether or not that part of the law can be blocked in court. It'll be interesting to see how judges rule on that.
Yeah.
Only a few minutes left. Quickly touch on this one note of good news this week, the EPA blocking Pebble Mine.
Oh, that was awesome news.
That was great news. The Pebble Mine has been in development for at least a decade, possibly longer. And during the Trump administration, it looked for a while like the Pebble Mine, which would site a huge gold and copper mine at the headwaters of the Bristol Bay, that mine up in Alaska.
Yeah, Southwest Alaska. It's a very remote area, really fairly pristine, largest salmon runs in the world, and it would absolutely be destroyed by this enormous gold and copper mine.
Yeah, now it looked like that mine was dead during the Obama era. The Trump administration resurrected the Pebble Mine by allowing the permit to go forward. And then when Biden was elected, the EPA has now stepped in and is pulling back on that. As part of a lawsuit by native groups, environmentalists, and fishermen, this week the EPA said in the court that it is planning to invoke the Clean Water Act to stop what would have been one of the largest open pit mines in the world. Now,
I have friends who fish up in that part of the world, and they were just horrified by this this proposed mine.
Yeah, it's the headwaters of Bristol Bay.
It would have decimated their livelihood, basically.
Yeah, the headwaters of Bristol Bay holds habitat for the largest wild sockeye salmon run in the world, probably the last healthy run of sockeye salmon left. The Bristol Bay headwaters are home to a fishery that includes sockeye, coho, chum, pink salmon, and other fish, and it generates more than $2 billion per year for commercial fishermen. In addition, and for sports fishermen as well. In addition, this habitat requires no hatcheries or salmon farms to maintain it. It's all completely wild and all completely sustainable.
And a lot of those fish, a lot of those commercial fisheries are based out of Seattle.
Yeah. So it's important to note that the history of the Pebble Mine shows that these decisions can be overturned when a new president takes office. So it's very, very important that you let your congressperson know that Congress has the power to pass a law to protect Bristol Bay and its headwaters long term, regardless of who takes office as president of the United States.
Yeah, because it also means that if a new president comes in, he can resurrect the
Yes, exactly. And laws that protect streams and wild fisheries are very, very popular in Congress with both constituencies. Both the Democrats and the Republicans tend to vote for things that will protect beautiful wild rivers and wild fisheries. So it's really important that someone from the Pacific Northwest proposes a law that would protect the Bristol Bay area and headwaters from development, particularly from mining and oil development.
All right.
Yeah, so that's our obligatory one item of good news for the week.
And probably a good thing.
We'll give you a few seconds to celebrate it, and then we'll move on.
All right. We are pretty much out of time, but if you could squeeze in quickly the update on the U.S. drone strike that happened.
Yeah, we're getting reporting in the last couple of days about the last U.S. drone strike in Kabul before American forces left Afghanistan. And this was celebrated by the Pentagon when it happened a couple weeks ago as having taken out a member of ISIS-K that helped plan the bombing that killed 13 service members. Well, it apparently didn't. It apparently took out the 10 people that were the extended family of young man who worked as an aid worker for one of the international agencies in Kabul, and the
including his children.
Yes, his children and his brother's children as well, mm-hmm. who were like 2, 2, and 3 years old. So the U.S. had claimed that it had observed him via satellite loading explosives into his car. Well, no, that turns out not to be true either. Imagine the Pentagon lying. He loaded water, jugs of water, into his car and then was taking those back to share with his family because, of course, water was at a premium in Kabul in the chaotic days after the Taliban took over. So it looks like the Pentagon has once again mischaracterized one of its drone strikes and killed a large number of innocent people with one family. And in some ways, it's a fitting coda to the end of the U.S. Presence in Afghanistan, which was absolutely littered with incidents like that and wedding parties and all manner of different events where the U.S. took out what appeared to be innocent civilians. And it's one reason why the Taliban was able to have such success, among the people of Afghanistan, because, you know, as obnoxious as they might be, they were better than the Americans. So, this, seems to be a fitting way to draw to a close the U.S. engagement in Afghanistan. To the extent that it has been closed, we also don't know whether the CIA or other groups are still conducting operations in the country. either through proxies or themselves. So that will have to await for further reporting.
All right. Which we will do our best to bring you in the coming weeks. So
yes.
On that note, we'll talk to you both again this same time next week.
We will be here.